do perhaps a correct analysis here if the short-form agreement, the first agreement, had not been fully executed. The first agreement was fully executed. It restricted any way that that agreement could be modified. Now, to illustrate the problem with what happened here, Your Honor, is the petitioners, if they were given copies of both of these agreements contemporaneously with when they signed them, the fully executed short form and the long form that was never signed by Mr. Coffey, they would have had to conclude that their 30-day opt-out right was never triggered because Mr. Coffey never signed the agreement that would modify the first agreement. And they had no reason to understand that the long form agreement was effective. This circumstance was created by the contract that the respondents entered into. They should be bound by the benefit of their bargain here under the circumstances. So that is the best way I could address that question. Now, in the Tallman case, the attempt to enforce
the... Before you move on to that point, why would you not simply construe the two agreements as different writings executed at the same time and therefore as comprising an entire agreement, one of which is signed?
Well, because the terms are in conflict, and the petitioners actually having copies of both agreements would not be aware of the enforcement of the second agreement. The second agreement...
The petitioners signed both.
The petitioners signed both. They signed them both on the same day. The district court found that the fully executed one, in fact, was signed first, but we know that they were both signed on the same day. So the problem is that each agreement says this is the full agreement. They both contain that language. They each have an exclusivity language, and they each say this agreement cannot be changed except by a further written agreement. The short form agreement specifically also saying that that further written agreement had to be signed by Christopher Coffey. And it never was. It is undisputed on the facts. So given the circumstance, I would submit as a matter of law, only the short form agreement should be enforceable. I mean, we had a situation where there were two offers made, perhaps, you could look at it that way. Plaintiffs, the petitioners, did manifest their willingness to enter into either offer. But by signing the short form agreement and never signing the second long form agreement, the respondents indicated that they were committed to the short form agreement, the first agreement, and they never told the petitioners otherwise. Again, the long form agreement contained a critical right to the petitioners to opt out after 30 days. How would they even know that that right was triggered looking at the record of what happened here? They wouldn't. So they can't be bound by that agreement as a result of this course of events. I think that is an inescapable conclusion.
And you would say that our review of the district court's construing that contract is de novo rather than in any way deferential?
I would submit it would have to be de novo, Your Honor. In fact, the district court in its decision never addresses the significance of the integration clause in the first short-form agreement. It does mention that there's an integration clause in the second agreement. And so, essentially, the district court was looking at this as a contract execution circumstance in a vacuum, as if only the second agreement existed, he assented to it, it didn't have to be signed by respondents in light of the petitioner's agreement. I would disagree with that conclusion in any event, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is the facts are not in the form that the district court undertook to conduct the analysis. It sort of missed the big picture here in terms of everything that's going on. In respect to the Tallman proceedings, the request to enforce the arbitration agreement in this case came 2 years after the litigation was commenced. So to the extent that the court does believe that there was an enforceable agreement here, there's a waiver issue here. The respondents had removed that case to the federal district court. They had completed all discovery that was necessary for them to proceed to have that case resolved on the merits. They were ready to go to trial or to have summary disposition. They then moved to deny class certification because, of course, the class certification issue had to be decided prior to a disposition on the merits. So they elected clearly to litigate this matter, in Tallman at least, in the judicial forum. It was only after that motion to deny the class certification was denied the case was severed and remanded back to the state court, that they came and sought to compel arbitration. Now, during this course of events, and this is documented in the record, various members of the class here became aware of these proceedings, and they actually did not proceed to prosecute or bring individual claims against the respondents in the hopes that these judicial proceedings would be certified as a class action, they would be eligible to receive relief as a result of those class proceedings. Now, this is documented in the record. There are declarations from some of the class members who stated that to the district court. The district court didn't really examine this issue in its order, but I would submit this element of prejudice in the context of these kind of proceedings is highly relevant, in that by maintaining this case ongoing in the courts for this period of time, subject to potential class certification, not manifesting any intent to insist that these claims be resolved on an individual basis, the respondents at this point can't seek to do that because of the prejudice that would emerge from these other individuals who were members of the class.
Now, who decides whether there was a waiver of the right to pursue arbitration here? The arbitrator or the district court?
Well, Laura, I would submit that it is a decision to be made by the district court in this case. But in all honesty, the federal, if we're looking at the Federal Arbitration Act, the precedents on that precise point are not overwhelmingly clear. There is some amount of disarray, but I would submit that.
But you're not arguing in this case that was a determination that was confined to the arbitrator?
I would submit that it is not, because it goes back to the issue of contract formation, which is when there was there an agreement, in fact, to arbitrate. What was it that was agreed that was going to be arbitrated? And, you know, the Federal Arbitration Act is quite clear that even though it broadly compels the enforcement of arbitration agreements, the question of whether arbitration agreements were entered into, whether are enforceable, are still subject to all the normal defenses or limitations existing under state law. Now, the district court found that because the class certification motion was denied, the request by the respondents to resolve the class certification issue in their favor was never actually reached on the merits by the federal district court. The federal district court simply said, look, I'm going to send this back to the state court without prejudice. I'm not going to decide it. The district court here said, well, that doesn't constitute a waiver. Well, I would submit that analysis ignores the principle that this court put out in the Nevada Golden Casinos case, where it's the election of the party to litigate a substantial issue that triggers the waiver of the right to arbitration. Now, in that decision, this court didn't speak of the election to litigate a substantial issue to conclusion on the merits. Just simply to ask for a decision on the merits of that issue is sufficient to show that there was a waiver and an election to litigate as opposed to seek arbitration. That clearly happened in this case. So, in respect to its analysis of the waiver issue, I believe the district court was clearly wrong for that reason, as well as for the prejudice reason, and for the fact that fundamentally, as a matter of policy, you have a situation here where a party has litigated basically on the eve of trial, has made the matter ripe for disposition in the judicial forum, got a decision it didn't like on an important issue regarding the class certification because it was unable to secure the relief it wanted, so then it is electing to go to arbitration and see if it can get what it wants in arbitration. A party having made that substantial commitment in the judicial forum to the dispute resolution process should be required to see the dispute through to conclusion in the judicial forum. Otherwise, it would simply encourage, you know, an abuse of the judicial process by parties. Now, the district court also ignored that for over 80 years, beginning with the passage of the Morris-LaGuardia Act in 1932, federal law has made it illegal for a contract between an employer and an employee to prohibit an employee from engaging in what's called concerted activity for the mutual aid and protection of their fellow employees. This is the historic ban on the yellow glove contract, where employers would prohibit employees from joining labor unions or engaging in other sorts of activities to improve their common lot with their employers. This has been a public policy in this country, as I said, for over 80 years, as well as in Nevada, which also has a state statute that addresses this issue. Now, the district court relied upon the AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion case. And Concepcion dealt with consumer contracts and the Federal Arbitration Act. It did not address the question of rights that are secured under federal labor law and how they would intersect with this sort of arbitration waiver agreement, class action waiver agreement. Now, what the district court failed to comprehend is that this is not a case, as in Concepcion, or say in Picardi, which this court decided shortly before Concepcion, where the petitioners are relying upon a state law doctrine that has the effect of limiting the scope of arbitration agreements. This is not about a broad rule as the Discover Bank rule that was at issue with Picardi or in Concepcion from California, where, as a matter of policy, the state is saying, these claims are fairly small in amount. They should not be compelled to be arbitrated individually because it will discourage their being able to be brought and so forth. What the Supreme Court said in Concepcion is that that sort of rule, even if it's sort of neutral on its face, essentially is a roadblock to the enforcement of the Federal Arbitration Act's objectives, and therefore it cannot be upheld. Now, petitioners here are willing to proceed to arbitration as long as they can receive the relief that they're asking, which is relief on behalf of themselves and their fellow employees as protected by federal labor law in terms of remedying the grievances that they are bringing to this court in respect to the violations of Nevada's constitutional minimum wage provisions, both for themselves and for respondents, other employees.
Could you comment on whether, and if so, to what extent, Concepcion overrules Picardi? I'm hearing you say that we don't have to address that because in this federal labor context, it's a completely different animal. But to my mind, I read the two cases, and it seems to me that Picardi has been pretty much disapproved by Concepcion.
There is no question that Picardi would not retain its scope of force in the federal court system. If this was a federal court that was reviewing the question of enforcement of an arbitration agreement under the Federal Arbitration Act and was looking to Nevada law for guidance, Picardi would have no remaining vitality. That is absolutely correct. However, I would maintain that Picardi still has its vitality in this court because in the Concepcion decision, Justice Thomas, who provided the deciding vote, specifically stated in his concurrence that he was not wavering from his view that the Federal Arbitration Act does not apply to proceedings in state court. This is a view he has held, I guess, since he's
been... But how many votes does he have for that position?
Well, Your Honor...
That's a confusing opinion to...
I understand. The reason why I point that out is that in Concepcion, you had four justices who felt that the Federal Arbitration Act's principles did not override this court's holding at Picardi or similar holdings. And you had the concurrence from Justice Thomas with the majority holding that it did. But in that concurrence, Justice Thomas was basically saying that I agree with the reasoning of the majority, but I still maintain my position that the Federal Arbitration Act only controls proceedings in federal court. So the conclusion I would say should be drawn from that is that AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion is good law, but it is only good law in the federal court. It is not binding on a proceeding before the state courts of Nevada, given the division of the justices on the court in that decision. Now, this issue was ruled upon by the National Labor Relations Board in the D.R. Horton case, and the district court said, well, D.R. Horton doesn't really apply here because this agreement was voluntary. And that ignores the reasoning and the holding of the D.R. Horton case by the National Labor Relations Board, which said because this right to engage in concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act is an unwaivable right, it doesn't matter that nominally it was a voluntary agreement that the employee didn't have to waive it. It has to be preserved. It can't be given up through this sort of individual agreement. And this actually goes precisely to the structure of Nevada's constitutional minimum wage provision, which also states that this is an unwaivable right that is bestowed upon the employee. And the right that's given under the Constitution is not a right to seek individual damages. The language actually specifies it as a right to enforce the provisions of this Constitution. Those provisions impose an obligation on the employee to pay all employees the minimum wage specified in the Constitution and to secure all possible remedies that are available in Nevada's courts to cure those violations of the constitutional provision. So it is a right to enforcement. It is a broad public right that is set forth in the Nevada Constitution. And the actual language of the constitutional provision states that an employee can, and I quote, bring an action against his or her employee in the courts of the state to enforce the provisions of this section and shall be entitled to all remedies available under the law or in equity appropriate to remedy any violation of this section, including but not limited to back pay damages, reinstatement, or injunctive relief. So we are speaking about a broad, expressly unwaivable right under Nevada's Constitution to have these standards enforced by the employee. And this also touches on the...
Doesn't the list, though, in the Nevada constitutional provision, back pay damages, reinstatement, or injunctive relief, suggest that class actions, which are a procedural device, would not be like that other group, and therefore that the constitutional provision doesn't apply to class action?
Well, the language is entitled to all remedies available under the law and equity appropriate to remedy any violation. Now, this court in the Jane Roe Dancer case versus Golden Coin recognized that the class action device is available as a remedy for the enforcement of wage claims in the state of Nevada, since that is an appropriate remedy for a violation. Well, the district court would have to determine whether that's an appropriate remedy, but the point is, the arbitration agreement says, no, this absolutely cannot be an appropriate remedy in arbitration. And it is walling off that possibility. It is limiting the substantive rights that are conferred upon the petitioners by Nevada's Constitution. And that clearly is not consistent with what the Federal Arbitration Act allows. It allows for disputes to be heard and determined in the arbitration forum. It does not allow for the enforcement of illegal contract terms or waivers of unwaivable rights that are unwaivable substantive rights, as opposed to rights that simply impair the arbitration process itself. This issue was discussed in the Calabasas case, the Sonic Calabasas case, which was just filed the other week by respondents in a supplemental briefing. It was decided last month by the California Supreme Court, which did discuss how neither Concepcion, the more recent Italian Colors case, allows the Federal Arbitration Act to overrule unwaivable substantive state law rights that are possessed by individuals. I would like to reserve the rest of my time if there are no current questions.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Ms. Piablo, I lose my voice. Sorry. May it please the court, my name is Carol Zucker. I represent the real parties in interest here, the defendants below. There's a group of them, depending on which case you're talking about, but you have CPS Security USA, CPS Construction Security Plus, EP Security Services, and two individuals who are officers and employees and managers of the company, the president, Chris Coffey, and the executive vice president and vice president of human resources, Scott Vance. Collectively, I'll refer to them as defendants. even though their situations differ because EP and Mr. Kopp and Mr. Barnes are not parties to the Tannen case. But what I have to talk about individuals, I will refer to them by name as the individuals, and then I'll refer to the corporate entities collectively just as CPS. But I think it would be easier to do it that way. We believe that the relief that's been requested should be denied. The district court properly compelled petitioners to arbitrate their claims. The district court was correct in holding valid, and holding was a valid enforceable agreement to arbitrate between the respondents and between the real parties in interest, the defendants, and each petitioner. The court, secondly, was correct in holding that CPS did not waive its rights to arbitrate against Mr. Tallman, arbitrate Mr. Tallman's claims. Third, the district court properly applied Concepcion to preclude the non-enforcement by the court of the class action waiver, rejecting the Discover Bank rule, and we believe rejecting Picardi's holding because it does apply in state court, and I'll address that in more detail in a few moments. Fourth, the district court was correct in holding that the National Labor Relations Board's ruling in D.R. Horton did not preclude arbitration of these disputes in light of the fact that the individuals had the right to opt out, and most importantly, that it was not a condition of employment. And I'll discuss that in more detail.
Could you comment on Mr. Greenberg's argument that only the first short-form agreement was effective here because your client did not sign the longer one?
Basically, here's what happened. There was nothing in the record to show, I'm going to preliminary get to the issue of the confusion issue. There is nothing in the record, there is nothing dealt with below to indicate there was any confusion or any potential for confusion in the petitioners when they signed these agreements. I believe that those two agreements are construed as one contract. There's case law to support that, the Whiteman case, for instance, from 2008. They should be construed together.
What about his argument that they're inconsistent?
Well, before you get into inconsistency, it's admitted your client didn't sign the long form.
Right. But the important thing is this.
So why should the court undertake to construe anything? How do we have any contract under the long form at all? Why should the court construe the two together? Well, what is there in the record? And for our review, where in this order does the judge explain why it's incumbent to construe these documents as a single agreement?
It's true that the judge did not say that. The judge construed the log form. However, under the case that we cited in our brief, specifically the McLeod case, where a party provides an unsigned agreement to another party, and the other party, particularly the party to be charged, signs that under circumstances where it's obvious that the presenting party assents to it, which is clear here, we know the reason other than to present it there, then number one, it then has operative effect as a contract.
Well, your argument might be persuasive if the district court had said that.
The district court
doesn't say anything like that.
That's correct.
So it's unclear to me why we would affirm the district court's compelling arbitration or deny the writ and allow arbitration on an agreement that wasn't signed.
But I believe that
most importantly, on an argument, and I appreciate the point you're making, but on an argument that you're making that the district court apparently didn't evaluate.
That was a concern. However, the mere fact that it wasn't signed by CPS under this court's case law does not mean that it has no effect at all. And that is when we get into where a party signs two agreements contemporaneously. And that's the Whiteman case from 2008, where you had an employee sign two agreements with two different subsidiaries of Bank of America within 3 days of each other. One provided, had an integration clause and no arbitration. The other had an arbitration agreement and no integration clause. The court held that, and we had some Collins versus Federal Savings, the court construed both together as a contract, saying number one, 3 days, if you make 1 day, 3 days is contemporaneous. Number two, they both deal with the same subject matter. They were both signed here, and therefore those should be construed together. It gives the same result that Judge Johnson found in the district court.
You distance yourself from the analysis she had in her order, construing that as an offer that was accepted. Her discussion was in the form of the way the long form was titled, offer to participate in arbitration of disputes, and she construed that to be an offer which was accepted.
An offer of an agreement to arbitrate which was accepted. I think that's what I just said. I don't distance myself from that. What I'm saying is that the court should construe both together, because what you have is you have an offer that was accepted by the petitioners that had been presented to them by CPS at the start of their employment, and another offer that was also accepted by the petitioners that CPS signed. The result is the same if you analyze them together, because there's still a class action waiver as part of the arbitration, and there's no commitment either way to whether class arbitration is required or not under the short-term agreement. So what you had, I believe, as Justice Strickland referenced at the beginning of this argument, why do we not construe them together? And I believe that they do. The district court did not do that. But if you look at them together...
Did you argue that the district court should do that in the district court?
We did not. We argue that we pointed out that there were two. We said there was an agreement to arbitrate, and that the agreement to arbitrate included class claims. And we did not get into that kind of detail.
What was the argument opposing your argument that there was... You say there's a contract to arbitrate. Mr. Greenberg says there is not. That was vetted in the district court. Did he make the same argument there that he's making an appeal?
Except for the confusion.
Or on his read.
Except for the confusion argument that counsel relates to Red Dot having been signed and not having copies. That argument was not raised by opposing counsel, but the rest of it, I believe, was raised.
Well, she acknowledges that on page 8 of her order, where she says the plaintiff proposes that of the two agreements, the long form was never in effect. Defendants never signed it. That's the argument counsel's making here, right?
Yes. There's no question that they argue that it was never in effect. The part of it that wasn't argued below was the argument that under the facts that there was confusion, there would be confusion on the part of the petitioners. That part is not in there. Judge Johnson indicated in her order that she surmised, I think she was well able to glean, she says, that the long form was executed after the short form. There is nothing in the record to support that. In fact, the plaintiffs have offered nothing to indicate the order which they were signed. They were given a packet, and they can't even say.
But who has the burden of establishing the enforceability of the long form? You or petitioners? Seems as though your client is the one who's attempting to enforce the provisions of the long form and urge the judge to do that. Your client hasn't signed it, so it would seem that you bear the burden to convince the court and this court that the documents should be treated together and interpreted together. Did you offer, and I'm sorry for asking two questions, I should let you answer the first.
I believe that we have the obligation to establish enforceable contracts subject to affirmative defenses being raised.
And so what did you offer that would is set forth in the record that would compel the court to read them together? Did you have a affidavit or a declaration from someone that showed the order in which these were signed, or would underscore the analysis that's contained? I think you said McLeod case? I get those.
Justice Hardesty, there is nothing in the record. Here's what's in the record.
Okay.
What's in the record is that they were both signed, that they were both signed on the same date. There is nothing indicating when the short form was signed,
mm-hmm.
whether it was signed before or after, signed by CPS, before mm-hmm. or after the form was signed. They were given a sheaf. The best that we've said, and this is based on what the plaintiffs have said in their declarations, they don't remember anything about this or don't know, that they received a sheaf of papers, or a number of papers, and they signed whatever it was. They don't remember signing an arbitration agreement, and they did not provide any facts indicating when it was signed, whether it was the short form came with a signature on it, or whether the short form didn't come with a signature on it. There's no testimony either way about that.
The judge's divergent view from the argument of the plaintiff that the long form constituted an offer is sort of dependent, isn't it, on the sequence or a finding of the sequence of these documents?
It is not, because if they were presented at the same time, and that's the best evidence in the record, is that they were presented at the same time and they were signed on the same day, and that they signed the pre-employment papers at the same time. That's what's in the record. It's not dependent on the order. In fact, the case law dealing with when you construe the two contracts signed contemporaneously as one contract doesn't require them to actually be signed on the same day. As the court pointed out in the McLeod case, the Markin case, there are courts that have applied this doctrine in addition to the Nevada courts that have found Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, 3 months as being contemporaneously quote unquote. So it's not dependent upon whether the short form was executed before the long form.
Was the white name case argued to the district court?
I don't think it was.
Didn't think so. Okay.
Is the existence of a contract to arbitrate on this record with these competing forms a question of law or a question of fact?
It's a question of law, I believe. Because there are two questions. One is the question of law as to whether they should be construed together. And there's also a question of law as to what the terms mean and what it means. But I believe it's a question of law.
So you say the formation of a contract in this case is a question of law that we should review de novo? Is that your...
Well, in this case, the formation of the formation issue is involves mixed fashion, in fact, mixed issues of fact and law.
Right.
One is that was there an offer? Yes, there was. Wasn't an exception. Factually, there was. What becomes the legal issue is, number one, whether you construe them separately or together, which I believe that there's ample authority to construe them together. And then, secondly, what those terms mean in the case of, has the plaintiff agreed to a waiver of the right to bring an action in court and the right to bring a class action. And those issues, that gets into a huge number of legal issues. So that's my take on this. The difficulty is that there is, we presented that they were, that the agreements were both signed on the same day, and that they were both agreements, and we provided those to the district court. The plaintiffs responded to that with nothing to rebut anything other than one agreement signed one day, one agreement signed the same day. No indication of the order in which that occurred. But I'm not sure that that's critical under the court, the case law of this court, the Lightwood case and Collins versus First Federal Service. I'm not sure that that's critical.
Could you address the issue that, you know, assuming we find the long form effect of why you didn't waive your right to arbitrate by your conduct?
Certainly. That's why I kind of want to go into a couple of the facts. What went on here was that CPS was sued by Tallman under two legal theories. The first legal theory was the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. And there was a pleaded collective action, which is like a class action, but you opt in, as opposed to a Rule 23 class action where you opt out if you don't want to be part of the class. And secondly, there were claims under state law, under Chapter 608 of NRS, and I don't believe it was specifically referenced under the minimum wage, but from minimum wages and overtime not paid under Chapter 608. All CPS did during the course of the case was defend itself. There was nothing litigated on the merits of the claims themselves. Nothing. No summary judgments, no nothing. What was dealt with prior to the time Judge Pro settled and sent the state court claims back to the district court, the judicial district court, was whether there should be a class certification or not. And the plaintiff said there was. CPS, or corporate defendants, moved to preclude class certification based on a doctrine that was very much in vogue at the time, which involved the incompatibility between an opt-in class action under federal law and an opt-out class action under state law, under Rule 23. And it was also litigated elsewhere in federal court, under federal Rule 23. The idea is how do you maintain both of those actions? Because the FLSA then becomes, as Judge Pro ultimately held, that he granted the plaintiff's request for the severance and remand, that the FLSA claim becomes dominated by the Rule 23 class action.
Did your client complete discovery in federal court?
We eventually did, not before the remand.
At the time of the remand, how much discovery had your client engaged in federal court?
At the time,
what does the record show?
What the record shows is that we had done some interrogatories, that we had taken the plaintiff's, took some interrogatories and docket requests, and we had taken the plaintiff's deposition.
And
Tallman's deposition. There were no opt-ins at that time. The opt-ins were just deposed later after the remand, when we still have the case pending.
But why is that not engaging in litigation on the merits at that point?
Sufficiently to
create a waiver.
The case law that we've cited, particularly in some of our supplemental briefing, deals with this issue. The primary, under the Nevada Grove case, the primary issue reviewed is what is the nature of the allegations. It's not that you are, it's not just defending the case, it is taking some kind of affirmative action that is inconsistent. The case law we've also cited in our supplemental briefing discusses
the problem began in state court, right? And your client removed it to federal court.
Because there was a federal question.
Right, but you also removed the pendant state law claims.
Yes.
Or supplemental jurisdiction state law claims. So they all go to federal court. You conduct the 26F conference. You engage in discovery. that discovery was on all claims. And had you, it looks to me like had you been able to remain in federal court, you were perfectly content to waive arbitration. It was when you were remanded back to state court that the motion to compel arbitration was made. Or am I misunderstanding this record?
Well, factually, yes. We did not move to compel arbitration of the FLSA claim, nor would we at the time. There's been more recently some case law indicating that you could, that you can waive a collective action. But because of the requirement of 20 U.S.C. 216B that you can't resolve a Federal Standards Act case without approval of the court, we really had our doubts as to whether we could even move to compel arbitration. We did not file a motion in the district court at that time. All we thought was class certification in terms of what went on for the court prior to the remand. In addition, there was a more than 6 months stay of the case
in federal court
because all the parties attempted to mediate the case. We had to wait for a date for the mediator, and it ended up having to be moved once, and so we ended up, that ended up happening. And then the 6 months later was when, 6 months after the mediation, less than 6 months really, after the stay was lifted, is when Judge Proe severed the state law claims. And we did that based on the plaintiff's request at the time that we had these cross motions briefed. Class certification, opposition, motion to deny class certification and opposition based upon the incompatibility. Ours was based upon the incompatibility argument. Once the case was remanded, it took a little while for it to get docketed back here in the district court. We had trouble anyway trying to pull it up. On May 2nd of 2011, the class certification motion was filed by the plaintiff, and 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, we filed our motion to compel arbitration. That was about 3 weeks after the Concepcion case was decided, which made clear that we were not going to face the public policy, or should not face the public policy argument that you cannot enforce a class action waiver. So those facets are into that. I am not sure, because I don't have a crystal ball, whether it would have come about, because there were hurdles to enforcement of a class waiver prior to Concepcion. And contrary to what the petitioners have argued, it's been made very clear by the U.S. Supreme Court, notwithstanding the nose counting that is urged, the Monument case out of West Virginia, the Supreme Court decided per curiam basically what had happened is, prior to Concepcion, there were two cases, Southland versus Keating, Preston versus Fair, that dealt with the FAA and applied the FAA principles to cases coming up from California, the California Supreme Court. And then some time passed, and frankly, it looked like the law was settled, the FAA applied in state court. Then applied to actions in state court. Then this issue began to be raised again, although none of the live cases, and in our case it certainly was, but it doesn't apply because of Justice Thomas's concurrence in the Concepcion case. But in January of 2012, after the district court made its decision, it was made very clear by the Supreme Court that it applies, and indeed what they remanded the California Supreme Court. California had a case called Sonic Calabasas, and it went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court registered but remanded it back in light of Concepcion, when about 3 weeks ago, the California Supreme Court issued the Sonic Calabasas case, clearly applying it to state court. That is one of our supplemental authorities. There also have since been other cases that have done the same thing. And there really doesn't seem to have been any doubt about that based on the authority that's come out since then. And I haven't seen any cases going the other way. The current battleground is, you know, what is the, how broad is the exception when you're considering statewide reasons not to enforce a claim. So the difficulty we had was that we had other authorities that went the other way to an enforcement of the arbitration agreement. But I believe what the case laws, you come right down to it, what the case law says, is that defending yourself in a lawsuit is not necessarily inconsistent with litigation, and there's no showing of prejudice here. There's a case in our supplemental authorities where the plaintiff contended that, well, they were prejudiced by the litigation in federal court before the demand for arbitration and before the court compelled arbitration. The court said that's insufficient. And one of the factors in Battleground and the other cases is, did you do something in the federal court that you could get in terms of discovery in arbitration? Arbitration here is governed, you know, would be governed by the arbitrator, but there's clearly expressed in the Jens rules and most of the other rules of the different arbitration agencies out there that the arbitrator certainly has the power. And of course, in construing, you know, if you look at post-arbitration, if you're looking at enforcement of an arbitration award, that not providing sufficient discovery is grounds for, if it can be shown to be prejudiced, is one ground, along with others, to vacate the arbitration award. But not only that, if you don't give discovery, if you don't provide for adequate discovery, you haven't provided for enough due process in your arbitration agreement. That's why CPS's pulls in the Jams rules, which permit discovery, although it's more controlled by the arbitrator.
But isn't the upshot of that argument that you'll never have a waiver of arbitration then? If you're saying that you have to engage in inconsistent discovery not available in the arbitral forum in order to find a waiver of the right to arbitrate, but now you're saying that all this discovery would be available in the arbitral forum as a matter of due process, the logical conclusion is you never would be engaging in discovery not available in arbitration because arbitration has to afford you something similar.
Well, that's the point, and it also establishes the primary factor. The Vatican said, what is the primary factor? How was the plaintiff prejudiced by the actions of the party that didn't compel arbitration, although they had a right to? And what has not been presented here is any prejudice to the petitioners. And the petitioners did a lot of discovery. The petitioners took depositions, and we took a deposed Mr. Bones, our VP, twice in PMK depositions. And there's been no showing that they were prejudiced. The only prejudice argued is that people knew about the case and were counting on it. People who weren't parties, who we had no knowledge were allegedly watching the case. And certainly these were individuals, if they knew about the case, had the ability to opt into it in federal court.
You're nearing the end of your time, but quickly, I did not see in your opposition briefs any contest to whether writ relief is appropriate given that our statutes on arbitration don't give a right of appeal from an order compelling arbitration, and yet you seem to accept the premise that, well, that doesn't matter, they can just come on a writ.
And I believe that is the difference between between federal procedure and state procedure, which is, you know, federal court, you can file notices of appeal, but I don't believe you can. And I think the precedent supports bringing a writ.
Okay, so you're not contesting that point?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In addressing counsel's discussion of the two agreements that were presented to the petitioners and signed by the petitioners, what I think counsel has not addressed to the court is the critical framework and language of those exclusivity clauses. We have two contracts, each of which says this is the complete agreement. But the first one, the short form signed by both parties, goes further and states that this agreement can only be modified through a written agreement that must be signed by Chris Coffey. So it imposes a further limitation on the manner and process by which it can be amended and superseded. So if we look at both of these agreements and we try to integrate them into one agreement, they each say this is the entire agreement, so they can't actually be integrated together because they have this critically different term. You can't read them together. So then the question becomes, well, which one is effective? And again, you have one that's fully executed that says it's the complete agreement, and further that it can't be modified unless something else is signed by Mr. Coffey, which was never done. I would submit the only logical conclusion here as to which one would be enforceable or controlling in this situation has to be that one that was signed and that had that exclusive provision regarding its amendment. It's the only consistent, logical intersection between the two and conclusion that the court could reach. In respect to the issue of the discovery, it was the requirement
that Coffey sign in the long-form agreement.
No, there is no requirement in the long-form agreement.
So isn't the order of the agreements important, especially under the Whiteman analysis?
Well, Your Honor, what the long-form agreement says is it supersedes any prior written arbitration agreement and or contemporaneous orally written statements or promises made by either party, and that it's the complete agreement. That is the language from the unsigned long-form agreement, Your Honor. Okay? It doesn't impose any limitation upon how it can be superseded or amended. Okay, so let's say the long-form agreement was signed first. The short-form agreement signed afterwards clearly can supersede it because this imposes no limitation on its amendment. On the other hand, if the reverse happened, the short-form agreement was signed first, the long-form agreement can't supersede it because it was never signed by Mr. Coffey, which is what the short-form agreement required. So I'm just saying the logical construct here, I think, either way, has to lead to the conclusion that the short-form agreement is the one that must be
the language of these agreements that alters the Whiteman analysis.
Well, yes, Your Honor, I have to confess I'm not familiar with the analysis. But I'm just looking at what we have in the record here and how these agreements were constructed by the respondents. And I don't see how else we can arrive at a different conclusion in that language in the two exclusive
clauses. Pretty well-established Nevada case law that even if you have a written contract that says it can only be amended by a signed writing, signed by one particular person, that can be orally waived. So therein lies the rub.
Well, we don't have any...
Although that wasn't litigated below. I mean, that's the problem we have, I guess.
Well, if that's the law, that's the law, Your Honor. I'm not disputing that. But we don't have anything on the record establishing that was the fact. And then we get to this critical issue in that one of the foundations of the enforceability of the long-form agreement is its supposed procedural fairness because it provides this 30-day opt-out period. But under the facts here, the petitioners could never obtain knowledge as to whether it was even enforceable. If they were looking at both of these, the reasonable conclusion they would come to is that only the first one, the short form, was enforceable, so they had no need to exercise their 30-day opt-out option. In fact, the court could just look at it and say, well, by bringing litigation, they clearly have exercised their 30-day opt-out right, because it was never in fact triggered, because they never got the signed agreement with Mr. Coffey's execution on it. In respect to the discovery that was conducted in the federal district court, at the time the class certification motion was made, the motion to deny class certification was made by respondents, all discovery relative to Mr. Cohen's claim had been completed. It was ripe for disposition on the merits. There was, in fact, an extensive stipulation of the facts that was entered into by the parties upon the conclusion of the discovery in that case.
Had you prevailed on your request for class certification, wouldn't that require a whole bunch more additional discovery?
The only issue on the class certification would have been the payroll records for the class members. That was it. There was nothing else that was at issue because we had stipulated as to the facts. Some factual stipulations and discovery had covered all the relevant policies for all putative class members. There were no varying issues in terms of the facts in respect to the class members, except the number of unpaid hours they worked each night, which would be taken from the defendant's record. So there really was no discovery to be conducted at that point. Now, it is true that after this case was remanded, severed and remanded, there were additional people who joined as parties plaintiff into the federal litigation, so there was additional depositions of another four or five individuals who joined that case and so forth. But the point is, they did elect to litigate this case through the conclusion of everything they needed to do to seek a disposition on the merits. They did ask for a disposition on the class certification issue. And in a sense, they were successful in convincing Judge Pearl that jurisdictionally he could not certify the class in this case under state law, which was why the severance and remand resulted. Plaintiffs only raised the issue of the severance and remand to Judge Pearl because, logically speaking, if he didn't have jurisdiction, which was their argument to deny the class certification, he had to send it back to the state court, which was where it came from. So plaintiffs were not trying to split this off and bring this back here in some way to avoid the litigation that was going on in the federal district court. And in respect to the issue of prejudice, as Your Honor, Justice Pickering, you were pointing out, it's not a question of defending one's rights. I mean, a party always defends one's rights if they're being sued or there's an affirmative claim against them. It's a question of how far they go, whether their actions constitute an election to, in fact, stay in the judicial form. And the issue of prejudice to other class members, I think, is important here. It was not addressed by the district court. And it's not just a question, again, of them defending, but actually seeking a disposition on the merits as to this substantial issue of class certification.
I missed something. I believe Ms. Zucker argued that you didn't argue this prejudice point or this reliance or this harm to these other potential class members to the district court below. What say you on that point, if I have her argument correct?
Are you asking me?
I was posing that question.
What I believe Ms. Zucker was referring to is I had raised an issue today about the fact that the 30-day opt-out period being triggered, the right to the 30-day opt-out period, could never be clear to the petitioners because of the absence of them receiving that signed agreement by Mr. Coffey. Okay? And I do acknowledge, although the infirmity of that execution was raised clearly in the district court, the resulting issue of the 30-day opt-out right not being specified to the petitioners, I will concede, was not discussed directly by myself or, I believe, in the briefs with the district court.
Thank you.
My time is up, but I am available for other more questions.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Both of these cases will stand submitted, and I thank both counsel for their briefs and arguments in this.